and Pacifica Audio Port. And don't forget to come visit us at indigenousandmusic.com to hear all of our past shows and learn about all of our great programs. Have yourself a good evening and a good night. Until next time, from all of us here at Indigenous and Music, adios.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
It is 12 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I say this is the beginning of the war, definitely the beginning of a war.
Israel launches a wave of airstrikes on Lebanon, killing more than 100 people, wounding hundreds more. We'll go to Beirut to speak with an independent Lebanese journalist and a British Palestinian surgeon who's treating some of the thousands injured when pagers and walkie-talkies exploded across Lebanon last week. Then press freedom groups are condemning the Israeli military for shutting down Al Jazeera's main West Bank office in Ramallah. The raid was broadcast live on TV.
Good evening. There's an order from the court to shut down Al Jazeera for 45 days. I ask you to take all the cameras and leave the office now.
Should we all leave?
This is an order.
Can I see it, please?
We'll go to Doha to speak with Al Jazeera's managing editor, Mohammed Mawad. And then to Georgia, where the pro-Trump state election board voted Friday to require hand-counting all ballots for the November election.
I don't know if you've heard, but the Georgia State Election Board is in a very positive way. This is a very positive thing, Marjorie. They're on fire.
We'll speak with a member of the Georgia State Election Board who voted against the change and with voting rights reporter Ari Berman on how Republicans could block a Democratic victory in November because of Georgia. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Al Jazeera's reporting Israel's killed more than 100 people in Lebanon so far today in a wave of extensive airstrikes, hitting more than 300 targets. Lebanon's health ministry reports the dead include children, women, and paramedics. More than 400 people have been wounded. Earlier today, Israel instructed residents of southern Lebanon to leave their homes if they live near any site used by Hezbollah. Israel sent text messages, made phone calls to tens of thousands of people in what Lebanese officials decried as a form of psychological warfare. Israel's also hacked into Lebanese radio stations. On Friday, Israel killed at least 45 people in a massive airstrike on a densely populated residential neighborhood of Beirut. The dead include 16 members of Hezbollah, including two senior commanders, Ibrahim Akil and Ahmed Wahbi. Lebanon's transportation minister, Ali Hamia, condemned the Israeli attacks.
The Israeli enemy, with all its continued crimes, with the excuse of pursuing Hezbollah, has targeted a residential compound. It has committed a massacre to a residential building against unarmed children, women at their homes. The Israeli enemy is taking the region to war.
Hezbollah responded to Friday's attack by firing a barrage of rockets into Israel targeting an air base and weapons factories. Meanwhile, former CIA director and defense secretary Leon Panetta has accused Israel of committing an act of terrorism by rigging thousands of walkie-talkies and pagers that exploded in a coordinated attack last week that killed at least 37 people, injuring thousands in Lebanon. Panetta spoke to CBS News.
I don't think there's any question that it's a form of terrorism. This has gone right into the supply chain.
Yeah.
Right into the supply chain. And when you have terror going into the supply chain, it makes people ask the question, what the hell is next?
In Gaza, Israel's continuing to target schools and shelters housing displaced Palestinians. On Saturday, an Israeli attack on a school in Gaza City killed 22 people, including 13 children and 6 women. One of the victims was a 3-month-old baby. Survivors said there are no safe places to go in Gaza.
We got displaced and came to this school. I left from my house after it was targeted and my husband and my 2 children were martyred. And we came to this school and thought it was safe. We thought this was a safe place. Then they target us. Where are we supposed to go if at a school we're not safe? We got displaced 7 or 8 times and I'm all alone with my 2 remaining children.
An Israeli airstrike earlier today in Deir al-Balah killed a mother and 4 of her children. Meanwhile, heavy rain has flooded makeshift camps in al-Muwasi and other areas of Gaza. Press freedom groups have condemned the Israeli military for raiding and shutting down Al Jazeera's Ramallah office in the occupied West Bank. Heavily armed Israeli troops were seen on live TV entering the office, confiscating equipment while ordering the office closed for 45 days. Israeli troops also tore down a poster of Shireen Abu Akleh, the Al Jazeera journalist, Palestinian-American, who was fatally shot by Israeli forces while covering a raid on Jenin 2 years ago. This is Al Jazeera's West Bank bureau chief, Walid Al-Omari.
This is a blatant attack on the Al Jazeera channel and Al Jazeera network and those who are working with them, as well as on the freedom of speech and the task of delivering the truth. This is an attack that aims to obscure the truth.
The raid and closure comes months after Israel banned Al Jazeera from broadcasting inside Israel. In Sri Lanka, Anura Kamara Dasanayake was sworn in as president today, becoming the country's first leftist leader. He won Saturday's election after campaigning to renegotiate a deeply unpopular IMF bailout signed during Sri Lanka's worst economic crisis. He's a Marxist and former student leader who's vowed to fight corruption and anti-austerity measures.
We have a deep understanding that we have got a challenging country. Our politics must be cleaner than this. There is a need for a political culture that people expect. We will commit ourselves to that. The public have a very negative view of politicians and politics.
In the United States, voting for the presidential election began Friday in Virginia, South Dakota, and Minnesota. Voting rights advocates are expressing alarm after the Georgia State Election Board, which is controlled by Trump supporters, approved a new rule to require election workers hand count the number of ballots cast on election night in a move that could significantly delay the reporting of results. Critics include many top Republican officials in Georgia. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris has agreed to take part in a CNN presidential debate on October 23rd, but Donald Trump has not agreed to debate again. Over the weekend, Donald Trump campaigned in North Carolina, but he made no mention of the scandal involving his hand-picked candidate for North Carolina governor, the state's lieutenant governor, Mark Robinson. Last week, CNN revealed Robinson had described himself as a black Nazi on a pornographic website a decade ago. He'd also expressed support for reinstating slavery. Much of Robinson's senior campaign staff has resigned after he refused to drop out of the race. In other election news, the U.S. Supreme Court's declined a request to put Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein on the presidential ballot in Nevada. The Democratic Party had sued to keep Stein off the ballot for failing to submit the proper forms. In Sudan, the UN is calling for an immediate halt to intensified fighting in the western Darfur city of Al-Fashir, which has been under siege by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces for 5 months. Fighters have targeted Black Sudanese communities in Al-Fashir as fears mount of more widespread ethnically motivated attacks. Famine's been declared in a refugee camp near Al-Fashir amidst a spiraling humanitarian catastrophe. This is Martha Pope, Assistant Secretary General for Africa, speaking at the UN last week.
Even while millions of lives are at risk across Sudan, hundreds of thousands of civilians trapped in Al-Fashir are now at risk of the consequences of mass violence as fighting engulfs the city. The stakes could not be higher. The risk of the escalation of fighting, fueling a dangerous ethnic dimension of this conflict, is well known. So are the destabilizing effects for the entire region.
On Friday, a group of Democratic lawmakers sent President Biden a letter voicing concerns over the UAE's support of the RSF. Ahead of Biden's meeting today with the Emirati President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed at the White House. World leaders are gathering in New York for the United Nations General Assembly and the UN Summit of the Future. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke on Sunday.
Conflicts are raging and multiplying, from the Middle East to Ukraine and Sudan, with no end in sight. Our collective security system is threatened by geopolitical divides, nuclear posturing, and the development of new weapons and theaters of war. Resources that could bring opportunities and hope are invested in death and destruction.
Ahead of the UN meetings, President Biden hosted the leaders of Australia, India and Japan at his Delaware home for the final Quad summit of Biden's presidency. The meeting came just days after Deputy Secretary of State Kirk Campbell testified that China's become, quote, the most significant challenge, unquote, the U.S. has ever faced. Climate Week's kicked off here in New York, coinciding with the start of the UN General Assembly. On Friday, protesters took to the streets around the world to launch the global climate strike ahead of the UN meetings. This is 16-year-old Lena Goings, an organizer with Fridays for Future in New York.
Since Climate Week is coming up, we really want to keep our message on top of mind for everyone who's attending. We want to make sure that people are remembering justice, equity, and ending the era of fossil fuels. We cannot beat around the bush with this. We have to make sure that we are prioritizing real solutions, prioritizing communities.
The state of South Carolina executed Freddie Eugene Owens by lethal injection Friday. He'd been convicted of killing a convenience store clerk in 1997. Hours before the execution, Owens' co-defendant signed a statement saying Owens, who is Black, was not at the store at the time of the shooting. In a statement, Owens' mother said, quote, "The legal errors, hidden deals, and false evidence that made tonight possible should shame us all," unquote. It was the first execution in South Carolina in 13 years. And the site of the worst nuclear disaster in U.S. history, the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania, may reopen to help Microsoft fuel its artificial intelligence ambitions. The nuclear plant has been closed since 2019. The plant's owner, Constellation Energy, is seeking to reopen it by 2028 after Microsoft agreed to buy energy needed for its growing fleet of data centers powering its artificial intelligence operations. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Lebanon, where Israel's attacked more than 300 sites today and fears of a broader regional war are growing. Al Jazeera and other media outlets report 100 people were killed in the wave of strikes today, 400 more wounded, as the Israeli army steps up pressure on Hezbollah. United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres told CNN he feared, quote, the possibility of transforming Lebanon into another Gaza. Earlier today, Israel instructed residents of southern Lebanon to leave their homes if they live near any site used by Hezbollah. Israel sent text messages, made phone calls to tens of thousands of people in what Lebanese officials decried as a form of psychological warfare. This is a Lebanese shopkeeper in Beirut.
I say this is the beginning of the war, definitely the beginning of a war.
This comes after Israel killed at least 45 people Friday in a massive airstrike on a densely populated residential neighborhood of Beirut. The dead include 16 members of Hezbollah, including two senior commanders, Ibrahim Akil and Ahmed Wahbi. Lebanon's transportation minister, Ali Hamia, condemned the Israeli attacks.
The Israeli enemy, with all its continued crimes, with the excuse of pursuing Hezbollah, has targeted a residential compound. It has committed a massacre to a residential building against unarmed children, women at their homes. The Israeli enemy is taking the region to war.
Hezbollah responded by firing a barrage of rockets into Israel, targeting an airbase and weapons factory. Meanwhile, former CIA director, former defense secretary Leon Panetta, has accused Israel of terrorism for rigging thousands of walkie-talkies and pagers to explode in a coordinated attack last week that killed at least 37 people, injuring thousands more in Lebanon. Panetta spoke to CBS News.
I don't think there's any question that it's a form of terrorism. This has gone right into the supply chain.
Yeah.
Right into the supply chain. And when you have terror going into the supply chain, it makes people ask the question, what the hell is next?
For more, we go to Beirut, Lebanon, where we're joined by two guests. Dr. Hassan Aboussita is a British-Palestinian reconstructive surgeon who arrived in Beirut last week to treat some of the thousands of people injured when pagers and walkie-talkies exploded. He's also worked in Gaza with Doctors Without Borders. Also with us in Beirut is Cynthia Issa, editor-at-large at The Public Source, a Beirut-based independent media organization. We're going to go to Cynthia first. Can you describe the latest in Lebanon, this morning's attacks that we hear killed, 100 people, injuring hundreds more, and then make your way back through the weekend?
Thank you for having me, Amy. This morning, between 6 and 7 a.m., as most people were still sleeping, Israel began its largest bombardment campaign of the year in South Lebanon, and then gradually it made its way to the Bekaa, reaching all the way north of the Bekaa to the Hermid. That's about 200 kilometers far from the border. These are locations that were not targeted up until this point in the war. And in fact, this is very reminiscent of 2006. We're talking about 100 locations or so, 50 or 100 locations or so between villages, towns, and various parts of the landscape. Jbeil district, which is not really involved at all in this war, was also targeted. Lu, this is also part of the psychological warfare that we are seeing. And the bombing itself, we saw plumes that were not necessarily the most familiar. So we're talking about bombs that may have been added to the arsenal for the first time here in Lebanon, or at least used in Lebanon for the first time. The scale is incomparable so far. Later in the afternoon, at around noon, we had maybe another 100 or 200 strikes in different locations. As you did mention, it seems like there's 100 people who were killed already, and several hundred more definitely wounded and injured. Sites near hospitals were targeted in a clear indication that what has happened in Gaza may be coming to Lebanon as well. In relation to this as well, southerners, but also different people reaching Beirut, but mostly in the south, received text messages telling them to leave their homes if their homes contains a missile or a rocket. Israel also infiltrated the landline network in Sur, in the south, and called people and told them to leave if their house, you know, contains rockets or if they're close to any weapons. There's also a series of videos that Israel has been circulating on social media platforms for propagandistic purposes. These are animations where you can clearly see homes, and inside these homes there are rockets lying there. And the same message is basically telling residents of Lebanon to leave if their homes contains rockets. So what we're seeing here is an attempt to manufacture consent for a carpet bombing campaign that will no doubt, perhaps, you know, let's see how far it goes, but it promises at least to resemble a little bit what we're seeing in Gaza.
So how do people know if they're near some kind of Hezbollah site?
There is a conflation that's essentially happening with southerners in Lebanon. There's a conflation between all civilians and Hezbollah happening at the same time. If the question is, where is Israel attacking right now? It's been fairly indiscriminate. We've seen that, you know, cities and towns, including the heart of Nabatieh, was bombed. So the Ghaziyeh next to Saida, also the square, was bombed. So we're talking about attacks that are happening in the thick of the towns, densely populated areas, not just in disparate places. And, you know, at the heart of this is an attempt to manufacture consent and kind of try to portray most Southernese as Hezbollah operatives, their homes as essentially depots and caches.
Hezbollah's deputy leader, Naeem Qassem, spoke at the funeral of Ibrahim Aqil, killed in Friday's Israeli airstrike on a residential building in Beirut.
The Lebanese support front for Gaza will continue, no matter how long it takes until the war on Gaza ends. Secondly, the people of the north won't return. Rather, displacement will increase and support will expand. The Israeli military solution only deepens Israel's dilemma and that of the northern population without solving their problems. So go to Gaza and stop the war.
So if you could comment on what he was saying. And also, I wanted to go to White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby, who told ABC's This Week the U.S. has been engaged in, quote, extensive and quite assertive diplomacy.
We don't believe that a military conflict, and we're saying this directly to our Israeli counterparts, George, we don't believe that escalating this military conflict is in their best interest. We want to make sure that we can continue to do everything we can to try to prevent this from becoming an all-out war there with Hezbollah across that Lebanese border.
Cynthia Issa, if you could comment.
Well, to be very clear, Hezbollah never intended to have a full-on war in Lebanon. That was not a part of their calculation or strategy at all, actually. They were very much interested in an intent on being a front of support and military solidarity to Gaza in the context of a genocide and ethnic cleansing. But Hezbollah never really wanted to have a full-fledged war. This is something that they stated themselves. And if we actually follow the facts on the ground, the actions, we will notice that they try to work within the rules of engagement, target only military infrastructures and never civilian infrastructures. And that was always the intent. It was always Israel that wants to escalate this into a broader war with Lebanon. And for an entire year, Hezbollah has been trying to de-escalate. Now, with what happened on Tuesday and Wednesday, with about 3,000 people maimed in Dahye in the span of seconds, and then another assassination on Friday that took the lives of 54 people, injuring many more. It seems like war is forced upon Hezbollah. And if war is forced upon Hezbollah, then they will they will do it, and it will be a fierce battle, and it will be a costly battle for both sides. Now, when it comes to the United States and John Kirby saying that, you know, the U.S. is very much trying to work for a ceasefire, again, if we actually try to compare the statements with actions on the ground, there's large inconsistencies there, and the Lebanese people and the Palestinians and everyone in the region very much recognizes that the U.S. is not, in fact, trying to work on a ceasefire in real terms. In fact, the U.S. is quite complicit in what is happening in Gaza and now in this coming war on Lebanon. It supplies Israel with 60% of the weapons it's using in Lebanon, in Palestine, but also in Syria. It's giving it diplomatic immunity in various UN Security Councils. And at the ICC, it's basically stopping any incrimination of Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu of war crimes and plausible genocide. So the U.S. has been playing a very important role in this war from the very get-go. And, of course, this question of peace process, you know, one remembers this question of ceasefire process, sorry, one remembers the peace process and the question of peace process. This question of process is really a ploy to extend the possibilities of capitulation, the possibilities of, in this case here, genocide in Palestine and increase the war on Lebanon. But the reality is just a ploy that's presented to give more time to Israel to do more. Unfortunately, that's the situation. Of course, the war is maybe a fait accompli or not. I think the war can come to an end, and there is a way out of this war. There is a roadmap. First, if the U.S. is indeed, interested in reaching a ceasefire, it would halt all arms supply to Israel right now. The 60% it supplies. And, you know, since the U.S. does sanction about 30% of the countries in the world, then in that case, it should be able to sanction Israel for committing wars, crimes against humanity and a genocide. And then finally, it would lift all diplomatic and legal impunity for Israel at the ICC, for example. So there is a road forward to end the war, and that's to be sure.
I wanted to bring Dr. Ghassan Abou-Setta into the conversation. You came to Lebanon last week. Interesting to hear the former CIA director, former defense secretary, Leon Panetta, talking about the explosions of the pagers and the walkie-talkies as being a terrorist act. Can you talk about the effects on the ground and the kind of injuries you're seeing with, I think at last count, 37 dead, thousands injured?
This is the largest act of mass mutilation we've seen, even more than in the civil war in Sierra Leone, where warring parties were chopping each other's hands. This is the explosive put in the pager was sufficient to maim and not to kill. And so what you have is over 3,000 with around 90% who have penetrating injuries to the eyes, some of whom both eyes, and a blast injury to the hand with what we refer to in hand surgery as a mangled hand, because what happened is the pager went off, the victims picked up the pager and then looked at it, and it exploded in their hand facing their faces, and so they're also facial injuries. Now, the act of booby-trapping these pagers meant that they went off when people were in their cars with families, when they were in their homes with kids picking up these pagers to when they went off. And so, truly, the aim of this was to mutilate. And I tell my colleagues here that it's reminiscent of the marches of return between 2018 and 2020, when Israel intentionally shot over 8,000 Palestinians in the lower limb with the aim of disablement and mutilation. And so this is an act that was designed at inflicting disablement, mutilation of the victims.
You know, it's interesting you talk about the seconds delay, that it's almost like a double tap bomb on a much smaller level, right? When a country bombs another country, and then as the rescue workers come running to help the people on the ground, they're bombed again. In this case, it was a pager, and so first it vibrates, forcing people, well, people instinctively then pick up or go over across the room to where it might not have hurt them, and then as they pick it up, they are injured or killed.
And also what happened the following day is that the walkie-talkies that had also been moved and trapped went off. And these walkie-talkies were being used by paramedics, by ambulance staff, by civil defense staff. And so there was a kind of second wave of similarly, but with bigger explosive quantities in them, with the same aim of inducing that terrible injury, paralyzing the health system, and leaving these people with permanent disability.
On Friday, you were operating on victims of the pager and walkie-talkie attacks when Israel bombed the residential building in Beirut?
Yes. And we, I mean, that was our biggest worry, is that it highlighted the fact that as a result of around 3,000 wounded in the hospitals, there wasn't any capacity left in the health system to take any of the wounded. And that's what forced a lot of the hospitals to push for early discharge of the wounded over the weekend, because we felt that the health system was very exposed with all of these injured people in the beds. And we felt that there's going to be another wave. And unfortunately, this came true this morning, that we needed to discharge a lot of the wounded early. You need to realize this comes at the at the end of a 4-year economic crisis that has really disabled the Lebanese health system and disabled the Lebanese government in terms of its ability to support the Ministry of Health. So you have around a third of the doctors and nurses emigrated as a result of the collapse of the Lebanese currency, and you have a health system that's mainly made up of small and medium-sized private institutions that, you know, don't have the purchasing capacity to buy the kind of medication, the consumables that they need. And those who did, it was used up on Tuesday treating, and since then treating the 3,000 wounded.
You worked for weeks in Gaza, treating the wounded, the injured there. How does what you're seeing here in Beirut compare? You told the New York Times the Lebanese health system is in no way able to treat war wounded. If it were to escalate into a full-blown war, we're stuck in this loop. You just operate and operate. You feel like you're playing catch-up all the time, Dr. Abusetta.
So when we had these 3,000 wounded all within a couple of hours of each other, they flooded the health system, which then meant that they were being taken to the operating room. Really, I mean, this is the biggest hospital in Lebanon, the American University of Beirut Medical Center. And we had 10 rooms going all the time. We were doing around 50 to 60 cases per day. And it took us from Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, till Saturday to finish the majority of the initial surgeries. I mean, these patients, especially for their hand reconstruction, will need between 5 and 12 surgeries over the next 5 years to regain some hand function, to try to limit the disability that's left. The eyes, that's the even more devastating thing. The eyes, the loss of vision as a result of these injuries. That's going to leave permanent disability. This is an act of kind of almost mythical mutilation. It's an act of mutilation, it was not an assassination attempt, but an act of mass mutilation.
Dr. Hassan Abusetta, we want to thank you for being with us. My final question is, you moved to Beirut in 2011, joined the faculty of the American University of Beirut Hospital. Your mother was born in Lebanon. Why did you choose to go back?
On Tuesday, I realized when I was in London, I had been in Glasgow as the rector, speaking at the opening ceremony of the academic year, and then went back to London. And as the news came about on Tuesday morning and Tuesday afternoon, I realized the sheer number and the type of injuries would require reconstructive surgery. And so that was the decision. I took an overnight flight from London on Tuesday night and got here at 8 o'clock on Wednesday morning and came straight to the hospital. And we have literally been operating since then. We're now trying to clear the hospital with the news of over 500 now wounded in the south. And we're expecting these wounded, some of whom to come here, the most critically wounded. The Israelis have been targeting cars on the roads full of fleeing families. And so we need, you know, I think the most important thing is that the humanitarian sector needs to realize that the Lebanese health system now needs help. Before the Israelis bomb the airport, it needs trauma teams to be brought in. It needs them to be fully equipped and fully funded in terms of consumables and medication, because the system is not going to be able to deal with this.
I want to thank you for being with us, Dr. Hassan Abou-Setta, British-Palestinian surgeon, speaking to us from Beirut, and Cynthia Issa, editor-at-large at The Public Source, also in Beirut, Lebanon. When we come back, press freedom groups are condemning the Israeli military for raiding and shutting down Al Jazeera's main West Bank office in Ramallah. The raid was broadcast live on television. We'll speak with Al Jazeera's managing editor. Stay with us. Sleep, Little One by Marcel Khalife and Umayma El Khalil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Press freedom groups are condemning the Israeli military for raiding and shutting down Al Jazeera's Ramallah office in the occupied West Bank. The raid was broadcast live on TV Sunday morning. Heavily armed Israeli troops were seen entering the office and confiscating equipment while ordering the office closed for at least 45 days. This is an Israeli soldier confronting Al Jazeera's West Bank bureau chief, Waleed Al-Omari.
Good evening. There's an order from the court to shut down Al Jazeera for 45 days. I ask you to take all the cameras and leave the office now.
Should we all leave?
This is an order.
Can I see it, please? This is the order which was brought to us by this office and his military forces. The order says that it is an order to shut down the office of Al Jazeera channel for 45 days. And this is a military decision from the commander of the central area and the Israeli military. It asks us to leave this office immediately and to take our personal belongings and our cameras.
During the raid, Israeli troops also tore down a poster of Shireen Abu Akleh, the Al Jazeera journalist, the Palestinian-American, who was fatally shot by Israeli troops May 11th, 2022, when she was outside the Jenin refugee camp. Reporters Without Borders responded to this weekend's raid with a statement denouncing, quote, Israel's relentless assault, unquote, and repeating its call for the repeal of the Israeli law that allows the government to shut down foreign media. UN Secretary General spokesperson Stephane Dujarric said Sunday the UN's deeply concerned about Israel's closure of Al Jazeera's offices in the occupied West Bank.
We're very concerned anytime, anywhere in the world, media offices get closed, especially in conflict areas. The journalists have eyes and ears of the world, and they need to be able to do their job free from harassment or any other type of impediment.
For more, we go to Doha, where we're joined by Mohammed Mouawad, managing editor of Al Jazeera. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you lay out exactly what happened on Sunday morning, Mohammed?
Thank you, Sami, for having me. It's glad to be back with you. When we spoke, when we last spoke in May, when the Israeli government took the decision of shutting down our offices in Jerusalem and the Palestinian and the Tel Aviv, I told you that the situation is ambiguous and the law itself upon which the Israeli government took the decision is ambiguous as well. It could be weaponized against us anytime when the Israeli government feel that the intimidation, a step of intimidation, isn't enough. They can go further, escalate the intimidation process. So that's exactly what happened. Our bureau chief, Waleed Al-Omari, was live on air reporting on the exchange of strikes in Lebanon between Hezbollah and the Israeli forces. Suddenly, the Israeli soldiers, these were not ordinary officers, but rather, a fully equipped and ready for combat zone officers and soldiers, and they invade, I say invade, not storm, they invaded the office, and they spoke to Waleed Al-Omari, who stood very strong against them, defending his right for freedom of the press, and he told them, why you are here? This is not a combat zone. This is a space for journalism. They said that there is an order to shut down the office, and that's a win. That the whole situation was shilling for us because, you know, this is a dedicated space for journalism. This is an office for reporters, for journalists. This is not a combat zone. They then went on to move from corner to corner in the office as if it's a combat zone. And then they tore down our late colleague Shireen Abu Akla's picture from the wall. Stole all equipments from inside the office, despite the fact that the order itself that was handed to Waleed Al-Omari did not mention anything about equipments. And then they went farther to follow our colleagues downstairs where they continued reporting about the incident. And they took the mic from Waleed Al-Omari and said, you're not allowed to work here, go home. But, you know, the whole situation here is not shutting down an office. Is not a decision by the Israeli government that was executed by the army, a fully equipped army, but rather an invasion to the very principle of the press freedom around the world.
Can you explain how the Israeli military has jurisdiction here? Your Ramallah Bureau, which is in charge of the whole West Bank coverage of Al Jazeera, is an Area A, an area marked as being under Palestinian control in the Oslo Accords. So what legal jurisdiction did Israel have to come in with their heavily armed soldiers?
That's why, Amy, it's very difficult for us to find a way to challenge this legally, because really, the whole situation is ambiguous. They say this is emergency law. This is according to the defense minister of Israel, an order by him to the army to enter the West Bank and shut down an office, which does not, does not include the power of the Israeli army in this area, because it's an area that is under the jurisdiction A, which is mainly for the Palestinian Authority to decide about. But you know, the whole Israel has no right to kill over 160 journalists in Gaza. I mean, and they've done it, and they continue to do it. They've killed three colleagues at Al Jazeera. They continue to commit atrocities against journalists. So it wasn't surprising. By the way, it was the least decision, the least action they have taken against us because we've lost the colleagues. But at the same time, it was a show of force, a show of, intimidation to show journalists around the globe that what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank isn't allowed to be reported about, and that the coverage of Al Jazeera is an enemy for the Israeli government, despite the fact that we haven't and we're not weaponizing at all, and we're not going to do that. We're not weaponizing our platform, despite the fact that we are being intimidated. We have lost the colleagues. Just before I come on air, we've been airing the Israeli forces press conference, and we continue to do that, despite the fact that the Israeli government shut down our offices in Israel and the Palestinian territories to try to delegitimize our coverage and say that Al Jazeera is a one-sided coverage. You don't operate there. But we continue to cover. We continue to make sure that we give voice to the voiceless, and at the same time make sure that it's both narratives kind of coverage.
One of the things you do on Al Jazeera when reporters are reporting on Israel, since you're banned from Israel, is repeatedly say that. That's unlike U.S. networks that don't say when they're reporting on Gaza that the Israeli military prevents them from going into Gaza. Talk about that editorial decision that you've made, as you have reporters in Amman and other places saying, we are not allowed to be in Israel as we report this right now, and what these images mean that you're broadcasting that others don't.
This is exactly what we should be talking about, Amy. Shutting down our Al Jazeera's office is the headline, but the name of the game is preventing journalists from doing their job, either in Gaza, in the West Bank. They want us to report remotely. They don't want us to be in the front lines. And that's crystal clear. I mean, the whole international journalistic community should be talking about one topic when they see a journalist killed in Gaza. They should be talking about one topic when they see an office shut down in Gaza or in West Bank or in Israel. The one topic is no international journalist was allowed to enter Gaza to cover the war there, to give voice to the voiceless, which is at the core of this and the principle, the main principle of this profession. We know international journalists, even the international journalistic community, is not placing pressure on Israel to allow their colleagues to get into Gaza to cover. Remember the Arab Spring, when so many American and Western journalists challenged the bureaucracy of the authoritarian regimes to go cover from Tahrir Square or from Tunisia or from Syria or from Libya. Right now, no one is placing that pressure. And it's really, really annoying, because we should be defending the freedom of the press. We should be defending the right to know what's happening there. We should not be shy from what's happening in Gaza and be part of this concealing that the Israeli government is trying to conceal what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank and the atrocities being committed. They just want us to report remotely, and we will continue to remind the world and the journalistic community that this is happening and that you should unite to place pressure on the Israeli government to give the right for journalists to enter Gaza, even after a possible ceasefire. This should be the case to uncover what's really happened there. I remind you that we still have 6 correspondents reporting from Gaza, and that's something that we are committed to. We are committed to give voice to the voiceless. An office is nothing for us. We will continue the coverage. We asked our colleagues to stay safe in the West Bank right now until we figure out the legal procedure, because as I told you, Amy, the situation is ambiguous. We can't really know on what basis that decision was taken, but we expected it.
Mohammed Amouawad, I want to thank you for being with us, managing editor of Al Jazeera, speaking to us from Al Jazeera's headquarters in Doha, Qatar. Next up, as Georgia's pro-Trump state election board voted Friday to require hand counting of all ballots in the November election, we'll speak with an election board member who voted against the rule change back in 20 seconds.
I never seen a real rainbow. I still believe, though. Gotta believe, though. It hurts me when people are fighting. Different street signs. Words cut like sharp knives. But it doesn't have to be that way. I will not believe that I'm the only one who has that dream. No, it doesn't have to be that way. What will it take to make you believe the change is coming?
Change is coming, Ruby Amanfu. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With just about 40 days until the presidential election, Georgia's state election board voted 3-2 to approve a controversial new rule that'll require counties to hand count the ballots cast election night, which could delay the reporting of results in the key battleground state, and that means for the nation. The proposal was spearheaded by the board's pro-Trump majority, will require the hand count in addition to the customary machine count in each of Georgia's precincts. Trump praised the electoral board members last month as pit bulls fighting for honesty, transparency and victory. For more, we're joined by two guests. We're going to start with Sarah Tyndall-Gazelle, a member of the Georgia State Election Board who opposed the measure. She's also an election law attorney. Welcome to Democracy Now! I know you just have a minute. Can you explain how this vote took place and what it means?
Certainly. We received a petition from a member of the public who is a well-known election denier a few months ago that would require the counties to hand count the ballots. Now, this is not a tabulation. This is simply counting the number of ballots that were scanned on the day of the election. We had another one that would have applied to early voting. That one, fortunately, did not pass. Rather than using the normal rulemaking procedures of working together, having the board draft the rules, this was one of dozens of petitions that came from election deniers, and they're motivated by people who believe the 2020 election was stolen. Now, mind you, there are multiple cross-checks on the number of ballots that got scanned through. There's a counter on the tabulator. The tabulator tapes have the number of ballots cast. The number of voters who checked in are already going to be cross-checked with the number of ballots printed and the ballots scanned. But this adds, at really the 11th hour, another layer of confusion, because the counties have already hired all their poll workers. They've trained their poll workers, and they will have been working for 14 hours. And now they have to hand count stacks of ballots that are, it's not like they're neatly stacked like a ream of paper. They're all going to be, they have to pull them out of the scanners, and rather than seal them up with a numbered seal that is a security seal, now they have to stack them up, count them three times, not just once, not twice, three times. If there's a single discrepancy, they have to start over again. And one of the arguments that my fellow board members made was, well, why are you sacrificing accuracy for speed? That is a policy choice that the legislature made 2-3 years ago when they passed the laws that had very strict reporting deadlines, which are now at risk of being violated. The counties are being set up for failure. But to me, one of the most troubling aspects of this whole thing is we were told by our attorneys, the state attorney general, that we don't have the legal authority to even do this, that this is untethered to statute. And yet my colleagues decided to go ahead and pass a rule that they don't have the legal authority to pass, according to the attorney general's office. That to me is the most troubling part of this.
I know you're rushing to get to the election board meeting. What do you expect to come out of it? And what's it like to be the only Democrat on this election board?
Sometimes it can be pretty lonely. I have to be willing to be the unwelcome voice. It's not just that I'm the only Democrat. I'm also the only attorney. And apparently the only one, aside from the chairman, who feels constrained by the rule of law. Today, we're looking at more issues that we don't have jurisdiction to be looking at. So it's not going to be a fun morning for me.
And can this count delay the national count for who is elected president of the United States?
Unfortunately, there is every chance that because the counties will not, some counties will not be able to transport those memory cards with the vote totals back to their headquarters to be uploaded for the rest of the nation to see until this hand count has been completed.
Sarah Tyndall-Gazelle, I want to thank you for being with us, a member of the Georgia State Election Board, the only election law attorney on that five-person board. In 2020, Georgia was at the center of Trump's false claims of election fraud as he attempted to overturn his election loss to Biden. Trump at the time told the told Georgia's Raffensperger in a phone call, quote, "I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have because we won the state." Georgia's Secretary of State Raffensperger refused, but many warn Trump is now laying the groundwork for another attempt at manipulating and undermining voting results in Georgia this November. Democratic Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock said Trump supporters are, quote, "trying to set up a scenario in which they could refuse to certify an election whose results they don't like." This comes as Trump allies in Nebraska are ramping up efforts to change the state's electoral college process to grant all votes to the statewide winner. Nebraska and Maine are the only states that split their electoral votes by congressional district. Meanwhile, in Arizona, the state Supreme Court ruled Friday nearly 98,000 people whose citizenship documents hadn't been confirmed can vote in state and local races. For all of this, we're joined by Ari Berman, voting rights correspondent, Mother Jones Magazine. Talk about the significance of Georgia and then just race through everything else, if you will, Ari.
Well, what Republicans are trying to do, Amy, is to, at the 11th hour, rig the voting rules to benefit their side in a really unprecedented way. In Georgia, they're laying the groundwork not to certify the election if Kamala Harris wins the state through a series of rule changes that the Trump-aligned election board have made. In Nebraska, they are trying to quite literally rig the Electoral College so that Trump wins or there's a tie and the election gets thrown to the House of Representatives, because the fact is that the Electoral College is already biased towards Trump because it favors small states and wider, more Republican battleground states. But they want to shift this one district in Omaha that could vote for Harris. They want to shift it back towards Trump so that either Trump wins or if Harris wins the blue wall of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, the election could be tied. There could be no majority in the Electoral College. The election would then be thrown to the House, where a majority of state House delegations, not state members overall, would choose the president. And that would be an incredibly undemocratic scenario in which a candidate who lost the popular vote, who did not win the Electoral College, could still be installed as president by House Republicans who would have the power to do so through gerrymandering and other manipulations of the democratic process.
And Maine?
It's too late for Maine to fight back. That is the problem. Maine also is one of two states that splits up its Electoral College votes, but Maine has to pass these kind of changes 90 days before the election, or they need a two-thirds supermajority in the legislature to do it, which they don't have. So right now, I think the problem is it feels like the Trump side is doing everything they can to manipulate the rules, and Democrats don't have the same ability to fight back. And Trump's side may have indeed waited in Nebraska for Maine to be unable to retaliate in order to put this 11th hour change to the Electoral College through.
And Arizona, Ari Berman.
So what happened in Arizona was the Supreme Court very late in the day said that people who don't show proof of citizenship when they register to vote can only vote in federal races, not state races. There were 100,000 ballots that were at issue in terms of people who the state claimed did not have this proof of citizenship. But the Arizona Supreme Court said that they actually can cast both federal and state ballots. And the interesting thing is these voters who supposedly lacked proof of citizenship, they were disproportionately likely to be Republicans. So it just goes to show you that when you try to suppress the voting rights, and they're trying to suppress the voting rights of Democrats and voters of color, there can also be collateral damage that hurts Republicans as well.
And finally, go back to Georgia, where we began, and the overall significance of this for the federal election.
What's happening in Georgia is incredibly disturbing because the MAGA-aligned election board, really at the 11th hour, is passing not one, not two, but three or more rule changes that could lead Republican county boards not to certify the election if a Democrat wins. That could plunge the state into chaos. Trump could then weaponize that disinformation. There's a lot of unpredictable outcomes there. That could also delay the counting of votes, which could send the election to the House. So right now, we're just witnessing all of these really disturbing efforts very late in the game to try to manipulate the Democratic process to Republicans' benefits. And they're basically using all the tools they have to essentially rerun the 2020 playbook to try to steal the election. But this time, they're running it before the election.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you for being with us, voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link to your articles. Happy belated birthday to Jackie Sam. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.